There are some gardens you see that are just breathtaking, and you know that a lot of hard work went into creating them and this colorful landscape. Other gardens that are equally as beautiful, requiring a whole lot less work. Larry Mueller here, glad you could join us today for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm going to talk about some sustainable gardens today with Jeff Epping. Jeff knows a lot about it. He's the director of horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. He knows a lot. And the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Jeff Epping, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, as always.
Great to have you here. If someone's not familiar with Olbrich Gardens, and this, believe me, this is a beautiful place to go. But Jeff, why don't you talk a little bit about the gardens itself and the variety that you've got there?
Sure, you bet. Olbrich is about a 16-acre garden, outdoor gardens. We also have a beautiful 10,000-square-foot conservatory, which we have a butterfly event going on right now.
Right now,
yeah.
So
the place is packed with people, of course. It's a great, great event. But our focus is display gardens. So we want to, you know, show the best plants for South Central Wisconsin, put them on display in different types of gardens. So we have everything from a rose garden to a sunken garden, perennial garden, herb garden. We have a Thai garden of all crazy things, which centers around a beautiful Thai, authentic Thai pavilion that was gifted actually to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so it ended
up
at Olbrich.
It's beautiful.
And that's a fun garden to work on, creating a tropical garden in Wisconsin. How crazy is that?
Well, we can zero in a little bit today. I know you're a big proponent of this sustainable gardens and sustainable gardening, and obviously you practice that over at Olbrich.
You bet. I've been at Olbrich for about 20 years now, and over those years, we're trying to to create gardens that don't have negative environmental impacts. I mean, we want everybody knows that gardens are a good thing, but sometimes we can rely too much on water, fertilizer, pesticides, those sorts of things to keep them healthy and looking good. And, we're trying to use plants that are well adapted to our climate when we create gardens. So, that old adage, the right plant for the right place. And to do that, you have to do a little research and figure out what it is that's going to grow well for you, and then create a design using those plants. And it could be something that looks like an English garden, or it could be something that looks like a sort of more wild prairie mm-hmm. type garden. So, but it's very important to know those plants. So that's what we do. And the gardens that I'd like to focus a little bit on today are our meadows, which are a good sort of alternative to our typical bluegrass lawns, which, we all know how much time and effort and money goes into those. We got some good alternatives to that. Rain gardens, which capture a lot of our runoff. Last thing we want to do is be polluting our lakes and streams and rivers, mm-hmm. of course. So we're trying to keep that water here and recharge the water table. The last is gravel gardens, which I'm really excited about.
Gravel gardens.
Yeah, which is kind of a new concept for us anyway. Our first gravel garden went in 2009. And basically, when I say gravel garden, people think of a rock garden. And yeah. It's really different. It's an idea that came out of a garden in Germany by a horticulturist named Cassian Schmidt. And a good friend of mine, Roy Diblick, who is at Northwind Perennial Farms near Lake Geneva, he worked on Lurie Gardens in Chicago at Millennium mm-hmm. Park. Friends with Pete Udolf was the major designer, went to Germany, saw this concept, came back to Northwind, a small garden, and tried it. And I visited him and said, "What is this? This is cool." And so he explained a little bit about it. And I think at the time I was almost more excited about it than he was. And so we put our first garden in then shortly thereafter, I guess that was the fall of 2009, at Olbrich near Herb Garden. And it was so such a success that we put another one in 2010, 2012. And then just last August, we put our biggest in yet, which is right out in front and center of our visitor center. So if you come over to Ulbrich, take a look. It's coming along fantastically already in just this first season.
What is it? Can you describe how it looks? How they might look?
You bet. Well, the main thing is this gravel. Okay, so we're using, it's basically, it measures about 7/16 inch chip gravel. It's about similar size to what we think of as pea gravel.
Okay.
And each piece of gravel is about the same size. So if you think about marbles in a jar, okay, they never pack, they never, you know, they never will create a medium for seeds to germinate in, and that's the whole idea. So this gravel is anywhere from 4 to 5 inches thick, deep, and you border all the way around with something, or if you have a sidewalk or a wall like we did on this last gravel garden, just use the parent soil, but dig it down, give yourself about 6 inches, then fill back in with 4 to 5, and once you have that in place, you plant your plants. And basically, you just sort of dig like a dog in the gravel, plunge it in there, and surround the root ball. And we're looking at like four inch, 3.5 inch pots, that size of a plant. We don't want to do big gallons. That's too much work and too big. You want to get them with the gravel surrounding them. So initially, if you can think about that, here's this little root ball surrounded by gravel on all sides but the bottom. And so they're pretty subject to drying out. So we have to water them very diligently for about the first 4 to 6 weeks, and then we can back off a little bit from there. But then the second season, maybe just during periods of drought, the new gravel garden we put in, we haven't watered yet this season because we've had ample rain, which is kind of unusual. But then in the fourth year, you shouldn't have to water at all. And that's what we've seen in these other gardens. And the beauty of the gravel in between the plants is that if a weed seed, does, and it will, of course, fall on top of that gravel, they got a long way to go down with a tiny little root to root in into that soil below and become established. Does it happen? Sure, it happens once in a while, but not very often. And if the weeding that you occurs in the first season is usually in the crown of the plants or in the plants that you put in. That was sort of a free gift you got from the nursery. So you got to do a little weeding there. And it's not unheard of for a sort of a dandelion seed to land right in the middle of a plant or something in the future. But overall, the maintenance is incredibly low compared to any other garden that we've ever put in.
It really is quite beautiful.
It is. And in this latest gravel garden, so the other thing is, obviously, we're using very drought-tolerant plants. We're using a lot of plants that are native to prairies, dry prairies especially. And in the new planting, we focused on a lot more natives because there's non-natives, too, that will do just as well. There's something in bloom all the time. We actually put bulbs in there as well, so they're coming. Bulbs love it dry during the dormant season, so they do fantastically in there. And it goes on and on, and we love it. The main chore is then in the spring, you have to cut everything back. We actually rake and use an electric blower to get all that debris out, because the thing that'll come back to haunt you is any organic matter building up in that gravel. That becomes like a soil, in essence, for weed seeds to germinate. But once you do that, you're good for that whole rest of the season. And so it's something that, I think is a nice application for, home gardeners. If they have a rough little bed, maybe in the parkway or at home, I have a bed between the foundation of my house and my driveway. It's only about 2 feet wide and it's hotter than heck, faces south. And I've done that sort of concept in there. It works wonderfully. We've actually brought it out into some of the parks now, over at Goodman Pool, here in Madison. We've done parking lot island plantings, and they're looking great. They're in their third season now. So
there
really
you
nice
go.
Concept. Really nice concept.
Jeff Epping, our guest today, Director of Horticulture at Ulbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Great to have him along. You can join in with your questions. And do you have a sustainable garden, or do you have questions about your garden, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Email question from Mike, who said, this spring I leased 2 acres of farmland from a farmer who used GMO corn and soybeans for years. I'm an organic farmer. The soil is beautiful, seems to be very tired from the years of chemical fertilizers that I refuse to use. Could you, do you have some advice on how to rejuvenate the soil to where it should be for organic gardening?
Well, I must admit, I'm not an expert on agricultural things as much as I am ornamental, but it seems to me that a cover crop of some sort, and probably something that would fix nitrogen, some of the legumes, would probably be a good start. And, you know, build up that soil and then plow that in after a year or two and build up the organic matter. And, you know, I'm not sure how long that has to be.
In order to make it organic,
out of chemical usage to qualify to be organic again. But I'm sure there's very extensive rules and such on that, and lots of literature available to figure that out.
Thanks again. You can join us, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You mentioned rain gardens and you as well, and you have some rain gardens at Olbrich.
Absolutely. Albury. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, when we built the new Rose Garden, so opened in 2005, we incorporated the idea of a rain garden in right off the bat. So we have drainage tiles in some of the garden and lots of walkways, of course, because we have a lot of visitors that come to Olbrich. So those walkways, of course, are not very conducive to letting water run through them, so it runs off. So we picked that up with some drainage here and there. And it's when we designed the garden, we had all the drain tiles go to that rain garden, which is just off to the side of the garden. But we didn't want it to be this little thing that, you know, everybody forgets about, and like, oh, that's the rain garden, whatever. We wanted to make it beautiful, so we actually put a boardwalk through it, and we used some nice ornamental plantings in it. So
really quite attractive.
I think it is, and I guess my beef with rain gardens sometimes is that they're planted and kind of forgotten about, and then you have a lot of, you know, weed seeds blow in, and after 5 years' time, it's kind of a weedy looking mess, and then people are like, "Well, this isn't a garden, this is a weed patch," you know, and it's hard for people to wrap their arms around that. And I think the most important thing is that we incorporate them into the rest of the garden, so they're literally seamless with the rest of your garden, not a little pothole stuck out in the middle of your bluegrass turf and a drain tile running into it, you know. So it's if we can make them ornamental, make people love them and want them, that's good for everybody. And we're then keeping that rainwater here to recharge the groundwater, and rather than run off, you know, down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Nobody wants all that good water leaving. We need it.
Yeah, we do at that. Rashonda in Platteville has a question for you. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Sorry. I have a vegetable garden, not a flower garden, but it is becoming overrun with Creeping Charlie. And I'm wondering if you know of a good way to get rid of it.
Well, the good news about Creeping Charlie is it typically does not root very deeply.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you're dealing with something like, say, quackgrass or Canadian thistle, and that invades, boy, that is one tough order to get rid of that. But Creeping Charlie typically is no more than a couple inches, if that, rooting into the soil. So, you know, using a rake maybe and kind of pulling it out, and then a hoe to get rid of it. And the trick then is to always keep a nice little border on the edge of the garden, because typically it's in a lawn situation and it starts creeping in your beds. I have some at home.
Yeah, well, I have lots of it, actually.
And it creeps from the lawn into the beds. But if I get out there every few weeks or whatever and just make sure that it doesn't get you know, within a foot into the bed or whatever, 6 inches, I can easily just kind of pull it out. And it just kind of peels up like spaghetti back and you peel it out. And, you know, the only way to that I know to get rid of it permanently is to use some type of broadleaf herbicide in the turf. Once it's gone, you won't have it always creeping back in. But if you want to stay out of that realm, then, you know, just mechanically pull it and hoe it and get it out of there.
I'm amazed at how much you can pull in a half hour.
Yeah, it's now, really,
just in
it's,
a half hour.
Yeah, you, I agree. It's really not that hard.
We actually, I get my daughter Emily out on our lawn because, you know, it's always creeping into the lawn. And in a half hour, an hour,
right?
Which you can, you know, that's manageable.
Right, exactly. And I think also go out and tackle it after you get a good rain.
Yeah.
Because then it comes up so much easier. If the soil is baked and hard and dry, then it makes it tough to get it, a little tougher to get it out.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer, as we talk with our guest today, Jeff Epping of Obrick Botanical Gardens, on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Appreciate you tuning in to Garden Talk. Next week, by the way, on Garden Talk, we'll find out how to help your lawn and gardens beat the heat during the dog days of summer. That's next week, but right now, talking about your flower gardens, and we zeroed in a little on sustainable gardens with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Obrick Botanical Gardens. So great to have him along. Join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Janet in Milwaukee next.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a rain barrel question, a little off topic.
That's all right.
No, that's good.
I've only had it a few years, but I noticed this year it's really starting to smell. Now, I did clean it real good this spring before I turned it back over, you know, because I had it upside down. But now the water's really starting to smell. Is there something I can put in that organically to take that smell away?
Hmm. Now, is it an open top or it had leaves and other things kind of fall into it?
No, it's got a screen on the top, so nothing can fall in it, really. Hmm. But and I've got a covered gutter guard system, so I'm not sure why. Last year it didn't smell like this, but this year it's really smelling. I thought something died in my yard until I walked by my rain barrel and went, oh my gosh, it's my rain barrel.
That's unusual, because if you know you don't have all that organic debris falling in there, it's
something. Maybe something's coming down my gutters anyway.
I wonder if it, I hate to think of it, but maybe, you know, a small rodent or something got in there. And
yeah,
that's
I'm
kind of
afraid to open it up. I'll maybe wait till my boyfriend comes over tomorrow.
I would just kind of empty it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did empty out as much water as I could get out with the hose. And then with his help tomorrow, I'll tip it over. But, yeah, in case there's something dead in there, I didn't really want to look. So you've never heard of that before and nothing to put in it to maybe... Because I don't want to put anything in the water that would hurt the flowers that I'm watering with it.
Right. I would think after you empty it out, you know, if you could do a little quick scrub with like a 10% bleach solution.
Okay.
That's what they kind of recommend for, you know, cleaning up tools and such. I think that sort of thing would help sterilize it. And then, have it covered good. And maybe check that inlet that's coming in and see if that screen might be off or something on the gutter or whatever. Something else is getting in there.
Yeah, get the boyfriend up there to take a look at the gutter and see what, you know, there could be dirt and other kinds of debris in there.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Perrin in Madison up next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing? Well, I appreciate you taking the call. My wife and I are the proud owners of a mid-century modern home in Madison, just the second owners in 60-some years. Mm-hmm. And we want to mimic that same mid-century modern look in our landscape. So what we've noticed is that a lot of the mid-century modern types of landscapes will use a lot of cultivars and also a lot of plantings that are more in the hardiest zones of like 7 and 8, and we're in that 4/5 area, mm-hmm. Being in Madison. So we're curious about what types of native plants might have that same sort of sculptural or structural look to them that would fit within that mid-century landscape, but would require less maintenance and also that would survive our winters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am embarrassed to say that I don't know what a mid-century modern landscape looks like. More because my wife is a realtor, and if she's listening to this, I'm going to hear about it when I get home. But as far as that look, I mean, I certainly you would be able to find plants that are hardy to our climate that could mimic whatever, you know, style you're after. And I guess what I would do is come on over to Old Brick.
Yeah.
Walk around, take a look. Our collection is pretty well labeled, and just kind of scout out some plants there that you think might fit sort of that style. Obviously, you're going to look at whether you know the plants that are at the garden and match the same conditions. So if they're shady or sunny, obviously that's the biggest thing.
Okay.
But you know, kind of go on that vein. Otherwise, what you could do is maybe I can get your email address here from Larry, and I'll shoot you an email from Ulbrich, and we can look into it a little further. If you have some photographs that would demonstrate kind of what you're after, we could give you a hand doing that.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. You come out and kind of scout around. I might even be able to kind of point you in the right direction where you'd find some of those plants at the garden. Happy to do that.
Yeah, I got to believe there are plants at the garden that would fit that style.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've visited Ulbrich on many occasions, and I've taken photos here and there of some of the plantings. I know some of them can be problematic because, like, some of the plantings near the Kai Pavilion, if you don't watch them or contain them, they'll end up everywhere.
Oh yeah, I mean there's plants such as like, you know, Liriope, maybe that's what you're talking about, a great little ground cover, but being a great ground cover, it's got some aggressive tendencies. So yeah, again, if you know what your plants want to do, you put them in the right location, use them to your best advantage, that's the way to go. So yeah, that's I think a good plan.
I will tell you what, I'll put you on hold. And Cheyenne's going to get your email address, okay?
Yeah, that'd be appreciated. Sounds like I'm...
Okay, good enough. So Cheyenne, if you're listening, she's on the phone. So talk to Perrin and get from Madison and get his email address so that we have that, okay?
So you really didn't know what a mid-century modern house looked like, did you?
No idea.
That's good. I don't either.
Mid-century. Well, a mid-century modern, well, if it's mid-century, is that 1950?
Okay.
A 50s home?
Right. Sounds reasonable.
Or is it 1850?
I have a feeling I'm going to find out tonight.
Okay. Well, parents, stay listening. And hopefully we'll get Cheyenne to get your email address here. Kathy in Washington County. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question was about the jumping worm. I had read that they've been finding that in Milwaukee as well as like in Ulbrich. And my concern was, how is that being spread? And do I have to worry about when I buy plants about possibly bringing that home?
Well, that's a good question. We do not have it at Ulbrich, thank goodness, but it is in the Madison area. I don't know all the specific locations.
Okay.
But, you know, I think you just have to be really careful about when you're bringing plants in or any type of organic matter. So, if Larry, you probably might even know more about this than I do.
I believe it turned up at the Arboretum.
Okay. Okay, and I've heard of some gardens in the vicinity that they found it in. I know the DNR is on top of it, and they're trying to, try to eliminate it as they find it so that they don't have the problem of spreading it around. But, it's hard because, in this day and age of, plants being moved and, people taking divisions. There's a plant sale on, it seems like, every weekend on every corner now, every garden club and garden like us, public gardens that are good fundraisers. And a lot of those plants come out of people's homes, and obviously there's soil in there, and you get whatever's in that soil. So, you know, it's one of those things I'd be pretty cautious about bringing plants in. Typically, if they're from a nursery in a soilless mix, you're probably in a you know, safer situation than if it were a division with garden soil.
And, like, do you have to be concerned about, like, bare roots, say, like, daylilies or whatever? Could they have eggs on them or not? I didn't even know if worms propagate by egg or how they propagate. I'm wondering, bare root, do you have to be concerned about anything like that?
I guess I am, you know, I'll be honest with you, I am not sure. But typically, bare root you'd certainly have less of a chance. And you can put them in like a 10% bleach solution before you plant, and that would probably be a good
way to
eliminate. But okay. I'm guessing, you know, after you said this, I'm feeling like I should get on the DNR's website and learn a little bit more and what their recommendations are.
And that's what I was going to say, Kathy. You probably you might want to do that too. Okay. Just get on the.
You bet.
Get on their website and type in jumping worm, and it's going to pop up.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Questions or comments as we, on this edition of Garden Talk, talk with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Jason in Appleton, you are up next. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a question about a Japanese variegated willow that I have planted.
Okay.
You know, the shrubbery type, pretty common ornamental planting.
Mm-hmm.
This year, planted it 3-4 years ago, it did great, thrived. Could barely keep up with it, trimming it back. This year, it seemed like it got a little patch that just died, and then that slowly crept over the entire thing, and now it appears the entire bush is dead. Thought, all right, I did something wrong, or something invaded, got a mite, a bug, something like that. Then I was driving home the other day, and I noticed that all of the willows that I see planted in the neighborhood are doing that to some extent. Is it, my question is kind of two parts. One, is it something environmentally? You know, we had a hard winter last year. Did it freeze? Is it winter damage? Or is it some sort of thing that I got to worry about planting another one?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So the willow that you were mentioning is a cultivar called Hakuro Nishiki. And it's a pretty common, often called the painted willow. And like most willows, it's a pretty tough grower, and willows will withstand, you know, excess moisture, but they don't always require it. They don't necessarily like super dry conditions, but anyhow, in your situation where you had such good luck with it, the first thing I was going to ask you is if you were gardening near a walnut or something where that first season it wouldn't have been affected because it's kind of the root system's, you know, in the same spot, and then kind of went downhill after that because of the jug loan issue with walnuts. But it sounds like you're seeing more of this problem around the surrounding area. I'll be honest here, we haven't had any issue with any of our willows, and I'm actually a big fan of willows. I think they have a great place in the garden. Actually the winter of 2012-13 was devastating for us, and I was telling Larry before we got on the air that we're still replacing plants in the garden from all the losses we had that winter. And we actually then saw trees still die this last winter. We had red buds, we had some bald cypress and such, and I think that was due to the fact they were damaged so heavily in the winter before that they were not able to build up enough carbohydrates last year to make it through this last winter. And so there may be some issue with that for you. In your area, have you had pretty decent rain this year, or have you been pretty dry?
Well, and that was originally, I thought, well, when it first started, I thought, oh, it's getting dry or something, you know, it's water problem. It's in an area where it gets plenty of water, so I watered it more, and it seemed like it just continued to get worse and worse. I had always thought that if a tree is going to get damaged or a bush is going to get damaged from cold, it's going to be that year or that spring. I'd never thought about residual damage years later.
Right, and typically
it never came back this year the way it usually does.
Right,
usually in the spring it just explodes, and we got to get out there and turn it back. And even that, you go 2-3 times trimming it back. This year it never really took off like it did. So either two bad winters in a row, or one and it never fully recovered.
The other part of that equation is the summer before was this one of the worst droughts we've had in history. So although we tend to forget about those things, and like this season we've had such good ample rain at the garden, we kind of forgot about all the other bad seasons previous. But it does take its toll on plants, and sometimes shows up a little bit later. And that would be my best guess. I think beyond that, if you wanted to take it into extension service or something where they can do send it to a lab, and maybe they can figure out a little more. But
the plant disease diagnostic clinic might have something to say about it. And you can mail it in to them. You'd need to actually, if you send photos, if you get good photos, you could send to them. They might be able to do something if you had good close up of the leaves and the branches.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I had heard about was root fungus and root problems. I was worried about pulling it out and putting another one in there and just having it happen again.
Yeah,
that's true. You might, if you can change the location slightly, that's not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. But the kind of the nice thing about the plant disease diagnostic clinic is that they'll know, because if there's other people with the same kind of issue, they'll have probably, believe me, they'll have they'll have seen it for sure. And you can go online to the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic and find out how to just email them some photos, send them some photos. And Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, will be glad to take a look. Oh, man.
He's the man.
He's the guy. Evan in Milwaukee, thanks a lot for calling. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, earlier this year in the spring, my wife and I planted an orchard, and we put apples and pears, peaches, prunes, and plums in there. And just within the last week or so, I noticed on the apple trees, it's kind of like a lacy or, light webbing and within the leaves, and something, and the leaves are curling up. And I think there's a little worm or bug or something in there, because it looks like the leaves are kind of turning brown or kind of blighted. Mm-hmm. But I don't see this on any of the other fruit trees. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if this is something I should dust or spray for, or if you can help me understand what might be going on.
Yeah, that wouldn't be unusual. They're all in the rose family, but of course apples have their specific diseases issues, as do, plums and cherries, are a little more closely related. I actually have some espaliered apples in my garden at home, and I've noticed that same little leaf rolling, I don't know if it's like a little caterpillar or whatever. And I it's not prominent enough for me to, I don't ever spray my trees, to be honest, but I just kind of go around and pick them off and squeeze them in my hand and do it the old-fashioned way. The overall damage to my trees, at least, is so minimal. I mean, I can't even think it's 1% of what's there. If you think about plants out in nature, they're getting attacked by things from all sides all the time, and most plants are perfectly good at fending off those little maladies, and they keep on going. if you, you know, I'm sure there would be some type of apple sprays or orchard type sprays that you could use if you're really concerned. But if it's very minimal damage, I'd say I wouldn't worry too much about it. Even a sharp stream of water, get your hose out there and, you know, sort of blast away. And it's amazing how easily those things are dislodged. Mm-hmm. And,
yeah,
you know, do it that way. And then the other part of it is, you know, keep those plants healthy. If this is the first season, you know, when they need water, because their root system won't be very extensive yet, you know, make sure that you're giving them a good drink of water, mulch over the root system to keep them cool and preserve the moisture. That sort of thing goes a long way. Healthy plants can fend off all sorts of diseases and insects. And, you know, our philosophy at Olbrich is just kind of, you know, give them good cultural care. All our plants, and again, paying attention to the little things, and we don't go out there and spray all sorts of pesticides all over the place. If they can't make it on their own after we give them everything they need, then, well, the compost pile might be the best place for them, and we'll try something else. Because, you know, like most gardeners these days, you know, we're not reaching to the pesticide shelf anymore for every little thing. It's plants really oftentimes don't need it, and in fact upset sort of the native balance of you know, the insects and the predatory insects that are feeding on those. You give them a little time, they can usually keep everything under control.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Evan, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. I'm Larry Mealer. Jeff Epping, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer with my guest, Jeff Epping. I was talking with Jeff about lawns, and lawns have come up, actually, on the show here already once, with a question relating to Creeping Charlie. But there are some alternatives that you guys can demonstrate over at the gardens.
You bet. And we're excited about some of the lawn alternatives because, again, they're good for the environment. They're good for the gardener because we're not out there, you know, mowing every 7 to 10 days. We're not, you know, fertilizing and herbiciding and all those things. And so, for instance, we established what we call a fescue meadow. And so it's a combination of about 5-6 different fine fescues. And mm-hmm. in fact, my own home lawn out mm-hmm. front is the same mix. And they call it a no-mow mix. I know Prairie Nursery mm-hmm. up in Westfield sells it. If you go online, you can look up Earth Carpet. Lawns, and they have all sorts of different mixes, and I think Jung's in Madison sells some of them, but it's the no-mow mix, and these fescues do very well and outcompete other plants under drier conditions, so they are truly drought-tolerant and love the heat, whereas most of our lawns, what are they? You know, bluegrass, Kentucky mm-hmm. bluegrass, which loves water and loves high fertility, where the fescues want just the opposite. So in that, we mentioned earlier that the drought of 2012, you know, everybody was watering their lawns yeah. just to keep them from dying, and the fescues were doing fine. You know, we watered them once or twice, maybe, but they just thrived. And so we have a little meadow garden that we developed over at Olbrich, a very small space that was bluegrass turf at one time. In the fall, we sprayed Roundup on the whole thing and then let the grass decompose over winter. We then took a dethatcher, actually, and went over it to create a nice shallow seed bed. Didn't mm-hmm. want to work up a ton of weed seeds. And then we planted this mix. And that whole first season then, we allowed ourselves to establish that fescue. And, you know, and we did spot spray with some broadleaf herbicides at times when we had some issues, but we did a lot of hand pulling too. And by that fall, it was a nice thick stand. And then we plugged in about 15,000 bulbs into there, minor bulbs, just like mm-hmm. Species, daffodils and tulips and fritillaries and all sorts of great things. So now in the spring, it is fantastic because those bulbs just got better and better. So how do we maintain that? We mow it shorter in the fall so that we can see the bulbs come up through in the spring because we can't get in there early enough when the snow drops are coming up, still snow on the ground. And then about early June, after it all goes to seed and has sort of a nice look that way, then we mow it, and then that's it. Twice a season.
That's it.
And once it's established, like I said, very little amount of watering, if any, depending on the season. Since that time, we've expanded. We have what we call the Serenity Garden. It's sort of the four garden over to the Thai garden. If you're familiar, that's a much bigger space. It's the same mix with very great success. And that, and just recently we've tried some tall fescue blends, and now they have these new turf type, they call them tall fescues, where typically tall fescue is a very wide blade, and so people, you know, looked weedy to them. Yeah. And that's the same mix they use on roadsides when they would do a highway. And so because of that, you know, why they use it is because it's a darn tough grass.
Yeah.
You know, it's salt tolerant, it's drought tolerant. And so, but these fine, the finer turf types now are much more, you know, palatable than those. Mm-hmm. And they're blends. And so we've incorporated a couple different blends of those too. One's called Green Resistor, another called Tough Stuff, you know, some good names. And those are that earth carpet product. And we have been sold on those. I mean, they are just frankly impenetrable to weeds. And again, we mow them twice a season, and that's it. And we're not having to water them. Yeah. And so, you know, when you drive across the landscape and see these immense lawns that people are mowing week after week, I just, it boggles my mind. I couldn't do it. And so if you convert to some of these mixes, you can still mow them. They'll still be, you know, we, of course, they get, the blades get up maybe 6-8 inches. But if you're not playing, you know, croquet on them or putting on them or whatever, that's fine. Now, if you want a more tight manicured type lawn around your, maybe around immediately around your house or something where you are going to be using that to throw a ball in or something, well, you can have that too. But, we just have too much bluegrass in this country. And then the other one that we've used with great success is a very beautiful native prairie plant called prairie dropseed, Spirobolus. And I think there's even a picture on the Facebook page of it in the fall. And there we planted plugs on about 12 to 18 inch centers. And again, this was previously a bluegrass lawn. And we converted it over, and we just put a gravel path through it so that you can traverse through, or at home, if you wanted to do something like that, you could put flagstone, you know, walk through it if you needed to, because it isn't very good for walking through. I'll be the first to admit that. But again, you mow it, or this last couple seasons, we actually burned it at Olbrecht, which was great fun. It was all legal. We got our permits, Larry. Don't look at me like that. So that was so easy. Burn it, and then it's good to go for the season. And again, super drought tolerant plant. Once you get those established, they're gorgeous. And so, you know, there's other great things like, you know, putting in a prairie. And I know you've had guests on like Neil the Bull and such that, you know, goes on and on. And I love prairies too. But for some people, that's maybe a little bit too much. But something like this is a great alternative, and a lot of fun, and you see a lot of wildlife in those types of situations as well.
Jeff Epping, our guest today, and you can see as he's been describing, if you go to Olbrecht Botanical Garden, you're going to see a lot of that very thing that he's talking about. Cheryl in Conover has a question for you, Jeff, so let's go there. Cheryl, hi, thanks for waiting.
Hi, I heard you mention the word red bud, and we lived in Austin for about 5 years, and there is nothing like the Texas red bud tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard you say red bud, and I'm like, wait a minute, I didn't think the red bud tree would live in our climate here in good old
cheesehead country.
Yeah, well.
Well, there are different species, and you're talking about Cirsus texensis, which is common down in that part of the country. But here in the north, we have Cirsus canadensis, or the eastern redbud. And it is a little far north even for the eastern redbud, so we have to be careful about getting a hardy seed strain. Most of the nurseries in this area grow that one, but you always want to ask the question, do you have the either northern strain or another strain called the Columbus strain? And actually, they may be one and the same, but they go by two different names. And Columbus comes from Columbus, Wisconsin, where there are beautiful old, very old trees there. And Ed Hasselkiss, who was a professor here of horticulture for many years, and is still involved heavily out at the Arboretum and Longenecker Gardens, he's the one who actually collected all that seed from Columbus and made sure that all the nurseries in the north were growing that. So they're hardy. And this is the first time we've had red buds die on us over at Olbrich during a stressful winter. But it was a tough one. And we didn't lose them all. We just lost a handful of them. And so, yes, I would definitely recommend it. It's a very fast-growing tree, likes to be in full sun, very drought-tolerant. It's a harbinger of spring for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you just can't wait to see them. And so, yeah, now that you're here in Cheesehead Country, you should check one out, plant one.
I will. Am I still on the air?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm so excited. I'm ready to jump out of my van and drive down to Columbus. You gave me hope. Gave me hope for a redbud tree. I have 2 acres.
Oh, fantastic.
And I would give anything to put redbud trees on my acreage.
Oh, absolutely. And it's like I said, it's a good, tough, drought-tolerant tree. So it's one that once you get it established, you won't have to do much with. But all the northern nurseries here, most of them carry it. So you don't necessarily have to drive to Columbus.
But you can.
It's a nice town.
You want to see those trees.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. Thanks, Cheryl. Thanks a lot for calling.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. Vilma in Wausau. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. My question is, my acorns are falling already, just profusely on a couple of trees. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why. They're fully developed, but they're not large. They're, small ones.
Well, oftentimes trees set a lot of fruit, and then midway through the season, they'll drop a certain amount because the tree can't support as many as started developing. And that's true even on apple trees. There was something they called June drop. And I noticed that on my trees at home, where all of a sudden, they were dropping little fruit here and there. But it typically holds on to a good amount of fruit as well. So I'm guessing that there's still a good crop of acorns on that tree if you were to look up into it, but you'd be a better judge of that. You probably have better, might have to pull out your binoculars. But
right. Yeah, they're quite small yet. But that was my thought, that it couldn't support them. But I just thought I would check it out.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Trying to remember the name of the book. There's a great book about oak trees and about how the oaks marched across Europe, spread by, and this is over hundreds and hundreds of years. It's a fascinating book, and I can't think of the name of it. Well, maybe somebody will call and let me know.
Yeah.
Hopefully they will. Steve in Sun Prairie, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I had a couple of questions regarding my garden. The first is rototilling. In the spring, I do a deep rototill of the garden to get rid of the weeds. I was wondering if that can be detrimental to the garden and the microorganisms, or if that's okay. And then the second question was regarding winter wheat or winter rye. I planted that a couple of times, and I was just wondering if that's how beneficial that is actually doing that in the garden.
When you say deep, by the way, what is deep for you?
It's a rear tying rototiller, so I set it as deep as it'll go. So probably 6 or 8 inches.
6 inches, Okay.
Well, from latest research that I've heard and read is tilling, is harmful to a lot of those microorganisms in the soil. So the least amount you can do, the better. And I know my with my garden, I've cut way back on that, and I haven't seen any negative effects of it. In fact, I've had a lot less weeds, and that's the other thing that you do when you rototill is you're bringing
up all
the weed seeds that were down, now bringing them to the surface and giving them a chance to germinate. So I'd probably keep that to a minimum. And then as far as a cover crop goes, you know, typically it's a good way to build up organic matter in the soil if that's what you need. Usually, you know, more organic matter is better for most of our soils, whether they be clay or whether they be sand. So I would think that would be a good practice.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. Heather had a called in and had a suggestion for our earlier caller who had the rain barrel odor issue. She says she buys feeder fish and puts them in the rain barrel to get rid of the smell because they eat away the algae that grows.
Interesting.
So that...
I would think if your rain barrel were in a very shady location, that you, I don't even know if they would get much algae building up, but certainly if it were in a sunny...
It was in a sunny location.
I could see how that, especially if it was like a white barrel or something where the translucent, you know, the light could get through. Because, yeah, algae is always an issue, and... over at Olbrich, you know, most of our pools, we actually just put a little bit of a dye in there, which does two things. It shades the water, so the light can't get to any depth in there and encourage a lot of algae growth. And if there is algae growth, well, we just hide it because we're dying in the water. You can't see it.
There you go. What? Well, why not?
All right. And we do aerate it. It is somewhat aerated, so it's moving, so it never smells. But and then at the end of the season, then we just, you know, clean up what's down there.
Talking today with Jeff Epping. Jeff is director of horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. I hope you'll take a look at their website. It's olbrich.org, and Olbrich is Olbrich, like it's old rich, but it's pronounced Olbrich. Jeff Epping directs horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And I'm really pleased to have with me today Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, for this edition of Garden Talk. He always has great information to share. We've zeroed in a bit on sustainable gardens today, but certainly interested in taking your questions or comments about sustainable gardens or others as well. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Jeff, thanks again for coming by today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here as always, Larry. Thank you.
We have callers online. Ruth and Wanakee up next with a question for you, so let's go there. Ruth, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a drainage ditch in my backyard, actually, between my property and an outlot that I use for a garden. On the one side of me is a manicured lawn, and they can mow their part of the drainage ditch, and on the other side it goes under the roadway with a tube. And anyway, I've tried to plant cattails in there. I'm fighting Canadian thistles and nettles and everything else you can imagine in this ditch that the village will not let me change the grade on. Mm-hmm. I can't mow it. We've lived here for 10 years, and I've been struggling with this. I've basically tried to kill everything out of it. And I need some help. It gets really wet, you know, rushing water in when we have kind of flash floods. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking I don't want to just grass it in and monoculture it. I want something diverse, but I also am afraid that it's going to cost me an arm and a leg to put prairie plants in there, and I don't even know if I can. Can you help?
Absolutely. I mean, the types of plants that you're going to need then are, you know, plants that are adapted to that wet situation and drying conditions, and that's basically... all these rain garden plants. And if you go online, you'll find a list of things you can use. But, I mean, some of the plants that we're using are some of the nice rushes, some of the native rushes, some of like things like swamp milkweed, which is a great, beautiful plant. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. But in your situation, one of the things you're going to have to do first and foremost is get rid of those invasive species that are in there, because you're not going to be able to get rid of them later. And they'll just sort of take over. So Canadian thistle, I think, is one of the worst weeds you can have. And I don't know of any other way of really getting rid of it other than using herbicides to tackle that. And you probably have to do it more than once to get rid of them, because they have very extensive, thick rhizomes underground. And it might take you a little while to get rid of that. But you might even call in, you know, a professional company to come in and at least take a look at it, consult on what it is, you know, the direction you want to go in. And then a lot of those same companies then sell the plants that you would need to move forward.
Okay, this is my question. I do happen to have a rain garden here, and I'm familiar with all those plants that you mentioned. Will they do all right when it dries out? Like now, it's completely dry, and there's grass growing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, we have the exact same plants in our rain garden, and yes, they do dry up. We don't want to water them. And that's basically what those plants are adapted to. If they were in, say, a wet prairie, well, wet prairies typically are not wet during the drought of summer. They do dry up, and so those plants are, you know, well adapted to that and move forward when the rain returns. So yeah, there's some a good palette of plants that you can use.
Okay. I appreciate that. That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks, Ruth. Thanks very much for calling. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Michelle in Brookfield, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, nice to talk to you both. I am gardening on a one-acre plot of land that it surrounds the house on three sides with woods. However, there are so many walnuts that I'm really limited, and I have tried pushing certain plants to see if I still make it, and what I'm ending up with in the middle of summer is kind of a one-note garden, Monarda, phlox, daisies, and I'd like a little more diversity, and the things that do grow just won't go crazy. We have a lot of natives in spring ephemerals.
Mm-hmm.
Jack in the Pulpit is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any suggestions design wise for me about what else I can throw in there to make it look a little more diverse?
Well, you know, again, you go online and you'll find lists of, I mean, I was just put somebody in this direction recently, and Extension Service has a great list. And if you want perennials, if you want shrubs, if you want trees, all the different plants that are tolerant of juglone. I know a friend has a garden that I'm familiar with, and the pagoda dogwood does perfectly fine. Oftentimes, the plants that are native to the same regions as black walnuts, you know, they've adapted to that chemical, so they're okay. But obviously, there's other non-natives that tolerate it as well. But one of the things that, you know, if you have big old trees, one of the things that you're going to be you know, dealing with other than the walnuts is drought. I mean, those big trees have very, very extensive root systems. So sometimes people say, well, I tried that and it said it was walnut intolerant, but it died after a year. And sometimes, you know, you start asking questions, and it was kind of obvious that, you know, when you went on vacation for a month and it was a month after you planted it, the plant probably just died because it wasn't happy in the dry condition and never really had a chance to get established.
Mm-hmm.
Spring ephemerals do especially good in that competition for moisture in woodland situations, because they're doing their thing when the trees are completely dormant and we have ample spring rains. And so they come up, do their thing, and then they're dormant again. And then the trees really start using the moisture. So that's another reason those are doing well in your situation. But again, I would just bite off a little, each season until you get what you want as far as a garden design goes. Doing it all at once sometimes can be, you know, can be tough because you have to keep up with the watering and keeping those plants happy and get them established before they will thrive on their own.
Mm-hmm. How about grasses? Are most grasses tolerant of Douglum? You mentioned prairie drop seed. That sounds pretty.
Yeah. Are most grasses? I guess I don't know, off the top of my head, but again, I'm guessing it might be okay. I know like switchgrass. I'm thinking about this garden that I know where they have the walnuts. Their switchgrasses are doing really well. White pine does fine in their situation. Oh. Redbud seems to do okay. Yeah, but like again, I'd hit those websites and they'll list all sorts of different possibilities.
Yeah, I've got lists.
Yeah, I don't. I must admit, we don't plant walnuts at Olbrich.
Yeah,
if we had some old ones, we would keep them to be able to experiment and talk more intelligently when I'm talking to people like you. But
well, the weeds things. Do just fine.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, the weeds don't have any problem.
Yeah,
how's
that? Yeah, that always is the case.
Well, they're
it?
Local. They grew up with black walnuts.
All right, thank you so much.
Yeah,
right,
thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh boy, that's why on sort of the vegetable gardens, people raise beds and this straw bale gardening is taken off because you don't have to worry about it. You can plant it right next to a black walnut.
Yep, absolutely.
Elizabeth in Columbia County up next. Then there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Give a call. But let's go to Elizabeth now. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Yes, hello. I'm in Poinette, about 25 miles north of Olbrich, and I seem to have a less than thriving tiger eye sumac, and I didn't know what Jeff had to say about this plant, if I should perhaps try to relocate it in the yard. It is, as it would happen, it's under a black walnut tree, so maybe that's part of the problem too. But what do you think of that plant?
Yeah, well, it's certainly a vigorous grower. I mean, and like most of the sumacs, they're very drought tolerant. They're best in full sun, any great amount of shade, and they kind of wane. But typically, they still survive unless it's deep shade. Walnuts. That's a good possibility that's having some effect, and
in the shade too.
Yeah, exactly. If you got both those things going, so yeah, if it's still a young plant and it's easy to move, go for it. And as sumacs are, they do transplant pretty easily. I mean, if it isn't like within a year or two old, where you don't think you're going to get much of the root system, then I would wait till fall or spring to move it while when the plant is dormant, because moving it in full leaf right now, with the heat and such that's going on, it might do it in.
Yeah, it's been in the same place for about 6 years, and every summer I look at it and I think, why didn't I move this last fall? So I think maybe this fall I will try that.
Do it, Elizabeth.
Thank you. You're
all right, welcome. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, we have a Facebook comment from Mark. The gentleman looking to rejuvenate his tired pasture and switch to organic. We talked with him earlier. Mark says that takes 4 or 5 years before the soil can be certified organic. He recommended seeding the area with organic alfalfa. That's kind of what you were talking about, too, I think.
Yep.
Then use some organic fertilizer like chicken manure pellets from your local feed store. At the end of the fifth year, slow the put it under the alfalfa, and there's almost nothing better than a field for a field than its own alfalfa.
There you go. Well, that's great advice.
I think so, too. And then a comment from Karen. She says, my husband makes a salad every day for lunch, and we take the peelings from the vegetables and dig a hole and throw them into it. Cover it up, and then within 2 weeks, the worms have made perfect organic soil we use in our native flower gardens. Easy work, no watering, as in other types of compost, and it's in a shady area to boot. We live on 2 acres, but I think it would work great in suburban lawns as well. No animals have ever dug up any of it, and we have plenty of critters.
Well, yeah, all composting is good composting.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a question. What's from Linda? What's causing the white powdery mildew on all of my peonies? It seems to have jumped to other plants as well.
Well, we've talked about it having ample moisture this season. Well, there's some bad that goes along with that. When you have lots of excess moisture, you also have a lot of fungal diseases, and we're seeing powdery mildew on not only peonies, but we're seeing it on some of the viburnums, we're seeing it on some of the lilacs, and I'm blanking out on what the other plant. But anyway, we're seeing it. We're seeing cedar apple rust and apple scab and those sorts of things pretty prominently in the landscape already. We don't do anything, I'll be honest with you. We just let them ride it out. Peonies are such tough growers.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's not the best looking thing in the world, but they've lived through this many, many years, and they'll be fine in the end. So, if you really want to deal with it, then there's fungicides out there that you can find at your local garden center. But we just look, turn our eyes to the beautiful plants and flower next to it, and all's good.
I don't do anything with it either. I just let her go.
Yeah.
Chris in Milwaukee, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. My question has to do with knocking down weeds. I know you're dealing with flowers, but we have a vegetable garden that we have every year, and we're trying to minimize the weeding work. And so last fall, we used three layers of newsprint with some soil on top method, and that did seem to help somewhat, but we still had a lot of weeds, and I'm wondering if you have any suggestions if that's a good method or not.
Well, again, I think any type of mulch over the top, or organic mulch that is going to help you out. I know I sometimes I live next to a park, and sometimes I let it go a little long, and all of a sudden you could practically bale it, and they leave that behind. I go out there with my rake and pick it up, and I use the excess grass clippings in between my plants. I know they don't use any type of herbicides or anything on it, so I'm safe there. Yeah, any type of that organic matter, leaf litter.
Leaves. I save all the leaves in the fall. And
exactly.
Put them in plastic bags, and you can put a 6-8 inches thick down through the rows.
Yep. Once they're right around the crowns of the plants, just don't pile it up on the stems. But other than that, they're happy to have that around.
Okay.
Some people use straw or marché, basically what's available and relatively inexpensive. Okay. Larry said, if you can stockpile leaves at the end of the season. I know I'm picking up leaves from other people's yards.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely.
To be honest with you, they're all putting them on the curb, and I'm over there grabbing them and using them as mulch in my own garden.
Okay, great. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate the call. And Bill in Prairie du Sac up next. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
Great.
I'm just curious. I realize there's no comparison as far as scale goes, but I've been to the Biosphere outside of Tucson, and I just wondered if you, the two organizations, have any ideas they exchange or ongoing experiments that might be in both of the structures.
Well, I can't say we do directly. No, I haven't had the opportunity to visit the Biosphere. It sounds like it would be a great.
Oh, I'm sure
place.
You would enjoy it greatly.
Well, it's you have people living right inside that domed glass building, I guess you could say.
Yeah,
in theory, it was supposed to be entirely self-sufficient.
Yeah,
but that didn't work. But that's what science is. You try it, and then you try something else.
There you go. Sounds fascinating.
We have. I do want to talk about another project, though, Bill, from Prairie du Sac, that you, I bet, would be interested in seeing come this fall or early fall, and that is a project called Gleam at Olbrich. And man, am I looking forward to that.
Well, it should be great. We have a local curator, art curator, by the name of David Wells, who resides over at Edgewood College, and he is actually curating this art and light exhibit for us. And basically what we did is we teamed up local artists with the landscape lighting designers. And so light is integral to each piece of artwork. So they'll be beautiful during the day as well. But then we're having we're open several nights. Check us out on the website for all the details of when we're open and such, because it's not every night of the week. But it's going to be great fun. And one of my passions over the years at Olbrich has been landscape lighting. So beyond just these pieces of artwork lit up, a good portion of the garden is too. And, you know, we've been trying to incorporate ways for people to get out at night and see that more and more. And this will be a fantastic exhibit. And I think everybody will get a kick out of it. And we plan on repeating this event every year. Not the same artist, of course. We'll always be getting new sort of themes and such in it. But yeah, I think it's going to be
really
a lot of fun. So it starts at on September 2nd and goes to right before Halloween. So we'll have all nice fall weather. And, of course, it'll be getting dark earlier then. So
yeah,
you won't
right.
have to stay up till the wee hours of the morning to see it, as you would now. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And, of course, it's all going to be incorporated right into the gardens at Olbrich. So there's a nice little pathway through.
Well, and props to you. I'm telling you, to visit there at night now, I mean, you do such nice things with light there
nice
on
there.
The plants. I mean, it's really, really sometimes breathtaking. It's really nice.
It is, and we are highlighting the plants. It's not like, you know, holiday lights, which is more about the lights.
Yeah.
The idea here is we're showcasing the plants. And to be honest with you, one of my favorite times of the year to see the lighting at Olbrich is in the winter. Because it is showing sort of the bones of the garden and the beautiful bark and form of trees that you don't always notice when the leaves are on and such. So yeah, it's great. And now with this advent of LED lighting, you know, a 20-watt bulb of old now uses 4 watts. So we use so little electricity to do it all, and something that I'm in love with at home, too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I'm always starved for light, especially during the winter months.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we have other callers online here. We're wondering, one caller was wondering if the book I wanted, I was talking about earlier, was As an Oak Tree Grows by Brian Karras. Mm. I'm not sure if it's that one or not, but that one doesn't ring a bell quite like I think it should ring a bell. So I'm not sure. But I'm going to look it up now because...
I Google that one.
Yeah, I actually had the author on my show. This is terrible. It's a few years back. And then I gave it the book as a gift to it. To another arborist that I had on the show because he expressed an interest in it. So anyway...
You'll figure it out.
Here's a question from Linda in Duluth. Can you use cocoa bean mulch on any type of garden, edible or inedible?
Well, you're asking the guy who really is not a big fan of cocoa bean mulch. Yeah. When I came to Olbrich 20 years ago, we used quite a bit of it. And what I noticed is it just doesn't break down over time.
No.
So it doesn't add a lot of value to the soil. You know, I'm a huge proponent of leaf mulch. You know, this is the mulch that's all around us, right? Every city's got trees, and you produce it. And rather than bring in something from hundreds of miles away, why not use what's all around us? And really, I think the leaf mulch is by far a better soil conditioner than cocoa bean mulch, which is so high in carbon that it just doesn't break down.
And on that note, and also it's not one you want to have your pets get into either, because the chocolate can be toxic to dogs, for example. So
that wouldn't be good.
Jeff, thank you so much. Always look forward to your visits, and I'm looking forward to your next one. Thank you.
I am too. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Go to olbrich.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. we have a link to the gardens right there. And you're gonna love those gardens. They're really beautiful. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.